The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio or Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of the station. Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell. I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, and business that might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. Today, the first book I'll share are highlights from 7,000 Ways to Listen by Mark Nepo, published in 2012. The second is Thoreau's Animals by Henry David Thoreau, published in 2017 by Jeff Wisner. It contains snippets of Thoreau's book, The Journal, which are notes he made on his nature walk from many walks from 1837 to 1861. So who is Mark Nepo? He's a poet and philosopher who has published 13 books and 8 audio projects, and he's a favorite guest on Oprah Winfrey's Super Soul Sunday programs. His work has been translated into 20 languages, including Portuguese, Japanese, and Danish. He enjoys leading retreats for those who work in the healing and medical communities. Mark opens this book by sharing, in real ways, we're invited every day to slow down and listen, because listening stitches the world together. I love that. Listening stitches the world together. It's the doorway to everything that matters. It enlivens the heart the way breathing enlivens the lungs. By doing this, we stay vital and alive. It's the work of being human, deepening our friendships with each other, and that opens us to the wisdom of care, the work of love, where we find that all of life is intertwined and inseparable. Listening is an animated process by which we feel and understand the moment we're in, connecting the inner world with the outer, letting one aspect inform the other. The title, 7,000 Ways to Listen, is a way of pointing to a path that has no end. Throughout the book, he includes reflective pauses with questions or a meditation to open us up to the meaning in our lives. Listening also includes the art of intuition. It's the art of discovery. Listening is important to Nepo because he slowly lost his hearing and he struggled to recognize what was happening. When he finally did, he was able to get the right hearing aid, and he felt it brought him back to life, and he realized how much he had lost for so long. He found that deep listening can reveal a different path in our life that was just waiting to be recognized. He shares the story of William Edmondson, who lived from 1874 to 1951. He worked as a janitor in the South for much of his life. In midlife, he had a vision in which he felt a seed had been planted in him to do sculpting. Though he'd never sculpted anything in his life, he began chipping away at a discarded block of limestone using a railroad spike and a hammer. He began to unveil highly original human figures and more. He took the path of saying yes to sculpting after listening. I checked online and found that Edmondson was the first African-American self-trained folk art sculptor to be given a one-person show exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. Nepo was fascinated with Edmondson and felt encouraged by his ability to listen deeply. He wrote that saying yes is the beginning of all personal flowering. On page 34, Nepo shares individual words from many languages that ask us about listening. The words are too hard for me to pronounce, so I'll just share what it means. For example, in African, there's a word that asks, how long does it take to listen when pain is all around us? In Albanian, how do we listen to what lives below whatever name we give it? In Arabic and Bosnian, how do we hear what waits in the stories that no one believes? In Bulgarian and Catalan, can we hear the sound of rain on cobblestones? In Chickawa and Czech, can we hear the sound of light being folded in a river passing under a bridge? In Danish, Dutch, and Finnish, can we listen like a hawk on a cliff wings spread to the elements. In German, French, and Hebrew, can we listen till we hear the lost sigh of millions as a yellow leaf is blown across their soil? In Hindi, Italian, and Japanese, seeing a plum, painting a plum, eating a plum, aren't these all forms of listening? And in Lithuanian, can we listen for truth like music to come out of silence and return to silence? And in Vietnamese, isn't watching rice sleep in water a form of listening? And then he asks us, the reader, can you find your own word for listening? He quotes Helen Luke, who points out the journey of life truly begins when we lose possession of what we thought were answers and we're left to accept that we're not in control. She thinks then we're really shapeable. An old woodsman told Nepo that the reason most people get lost is because they don't go far enough. They doubt where they are and change direction too soon. Sometimes we're called to lean forward by what little light we're given. Listening is the pull that asks us to lean into all that we don't know. It's the work of intuition, to learn what we're born with and discover seeds that want to be watered in order to fully blossom in our lives. So now's a good time to ask, are you holding your breath anywhere in life? What will it take for you to breathe more deeply? What can you add to your own practice of listening from other great listeners? Are you listening for the learnings you were born with? Are you letting injury or limitation of one thing or another limit all things? Are you listening to that part of life that's trying to wake you up? What old definition or plan can you put down that will open you to the freshness of the moment? The inner energy of all things is always emanating, so we can relax and finally receive what it's offering. For Nepo, deep listening is a relaxation where he enters the silence and stays with it until he hears it enter into him. Deep listening holds everything he knows open until what can't be seen or heard is felt thoroughly enough to change his mind. He explains that not only does it change the content of his mind, thought, though it is significant itself, but it's like water rushing through an inlet changes the shape of the inlet. Listening with this degree of openness can alter our experience. In this way, relaxing, waiting, is more than just waiting. Nepo reminds us that we're close to Earth. We're so close, we often forget it's alive. And the language of its aliveness is what we call nature. When we listen to nature, we're listening to the Earth. Of course, such a conversation takes time because we're too small to really grasp what the Earth has to say. The vast Earth has carried us our whole lives. Do we thank it? It has held up and endured everything for thousands of years. Can we ask it how? It speaks with 1,000 tongues, none of which uses words. Yet to build a relationship with that which holds us seems essential. You know, it's humbling to realize that though we need the elements of nature, we cannot survive their immense force. Nepo recalls 10 years earlier, he visited the Continental Divide in the Rocky Mountains. He went through Estes Park in Colorado. As he made his way up past the tree line into the tundra, the bareness, it felt so cold and forbidding, as well as magnificent. He stopped and sat in the crook of a large rock overlooking a canyon. He sat there long enough for the awe and wonder to dissipate. And just then, a mountain jay teased its way near him, swooping higher into the mountain air where humans can't go. And at that moment, he heard the jay and the mountain air and the cold stone holding him say in the utter silence, "Go back among the living where you belong." He felt shocked, but he knew it was true. It made him realize that we're welcome to make a pilgrimage up that far in the thin air. He was welcome to be humbled, but humans are meant to live lower, moving among the roots and the branches, following the elusive songs of birds and the tracks of shy animals, all calling us to remember our fundamental nature. Nepo shares three other stories of wonder. The first is about a little boy, no more than 5, who lived in a cottage near the sea. Night after night, the roll and rush of the sea kept washing through his mind. The boy grew up to be pianist Michael Jones, whose music always sounds like the sea. Michael describes it as a sense of playing and being played, which calls for deep and constant listening, to the waves of the deep. Personally, I have 4 of Michael Jones' CDs, and they're always calming, and I smile, and I feel that inner peace listening to the sounds of the sea. The second story is from a friend of his who lives in Walla Walla, Washington, which is the name of a Native American tribe in that area. The area is laced with a network of underground springs that surface through the freshwater rivers. It reminds him of this unseen connection of water just below the surface and the sound that the many waters make. And if you close your eyes while you sit by the rivers, you hear, Walla Walla, Walla Walla. The tribe and the town appreciate this wonder and believe that things worth honoring are named twice, and so naming the Walla Walla, because listening is the beginning of their prayers. The third story is about Nepo's friend Alan Locus, who has devoted years to playing the Native American flute. The flute's origin goes something like this. All creatures had found their sound, but the human's song was missing. And so the Great Spirit spoke to his friends, and in time a tree branch was hollowed out by erosion, and the woodpeckers pecked many holes into it. Finally it fell to the ground in the pathway of humans. A young man picked up the branch just when a bird flew overhead and offered its call. The young man thought the bird's song came from the hollowed branch, but he realized it had not. So he closed his eyes, and breathing across the holes, he prayed for the bird's song to return, but to his surprise, he birthed a song of his own. This ethic of wonder is how we listen to the earth, waiting for the gift until things that matter repeat themselves through our love, until we kiss the hallowed things put in our way. All of this leads to our song. Nepo wrote that if the purpose and gift of love is to awaken and reawaken what's dormant in us, then when we're awake, it's our responsibility to stay awake and give the gift. We do this by deep listening. Not toward a goal or even a noble ambition, but staying devoted to listening with our heart, more than once, to everything. And so life waits full-born in the moments of our lives. How we meet and listen to these moments unfolds the path of our own transformation. And we can meet such a moment in our youth or our 30s or carry it like a seed until some experience waters that seed and it opens years later. The opening of that moment from the inside out may blossom and change everything. You know, when we can treat what comes our way, not as an object, but as a meeting with a deep, living thing, then deep listening evokes a devotion that whispers, stay in relationship with everything. KKRN is a radio station, community radio station, supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. Or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through EasyCar. I always get that mixed up. CarEasy.org. And if you have questions, give us a call. 1-530-337-1885. The second book is Thoreau's Animals by Henry David Thoreau, published in an edited edition in 2017. Who was Henry David Thoreau? He was born in 1817 and lived all his life in Concord, Massachusetts. When he graduated from Harvard University, the country was in a depression, so he worked at his father's pencil factory and also started a school. In 1845, he decided to spend more time on his writing, and he embarked on a 2-year experiment in simple living. He built a small house on 14 acres of land around the shores of Walden Pond, and that was owned by his friend and neighbor, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Thoreau recorded his thoughts and interactions with the birds and bees and all the life in the area. His biggest virtue, it was said, is his awareness. In his book, Walden, he attests to the importance of being forever on the alert and of the discipline of looking always at what is to be seen. But its primary value lies in the way it affects the quality of our life experience. This book, Thoreau's Animals, contains snippets from the 2 million words that make up his journal. It's his thoughts and stories about his seemingly endless days tracking and studying animals. His sightings and experiences are arranged by the day of the year, and it also includes sketches from his original illustrations. You know, the turn of the seasons was of deep interest to him regarding how all life emerged from a frozen winter to the incredible phenomena of spring. So let's begin with Thoreau's notes on March 2nd, 1855. Heard two hawks scream. There was something truly March-like in it, like a prolonged blast of whistling of the wind through a crevice in the sky, as if a cracked blue saucer overlapped the woods. Such are the first rude notes in his notebook while leaning into the wind. March 3rd. Walking by the Solidago oak on the bank, I heard a faint rippling note. I looked up and saw about 15 snow buntings sitting in the top of the oak, all with their breasts towards me, sitting so still and so white. They did not look like birds, but the ghosts of birds. I heard a low, soft, rippling note from them, but I couldn't see their features, only the general outline of plump birds in white. When they flew away, like ordinary buntings, they were almost concealed, lost in the same color as the cloudy sky. March 5th. Going downtown this a.m., I heard a white-breasted nuthatch on an elm within 20 feet, uttering peculiar notes and more like a song that I remember hearing. There was a black-capped chickadee close by to which the nuthatch was addressing. It occurred to me that this nuthatch may be the earliest spring note that I hear, even before the bluebird, the blackbird, or the robin. The nuthatch paused in its progress around the tree trunk and uttered this lively but very peculiar inarticulate song, a note so dry that you might mistake it for the trapping of a woodpecker. It was as if the young nuthatch in its hole had listened only to the tapping of woodpeckers and learned that music, which it tried to sing. Interesting where my thoughts are taking me this spring day. March 10th. What was that sound that came on the softened air? It was the warble of the first bluebird from that scraggy apple orchard yonder. When this is heard, spring has arrived. March 11th. By the riverside, I hear many song sparrows, and in the swamp on top of a white oak by the stone bridge, I see and hear a red-winged blackbird. It sings almost steadily on its perch, all alone, as to attract a companion. The birds have come to melt the ice with their songs. March 15th. This afternoon, I throw off my outside coat. A mild spring day. I hike to the great meadows where the air is full of bluebirds. The villagers are out in the sun and everyone is happy whose work takes them outdoors. I lean over a rail to hear what is in the air. Liquid with the bluebird's warble. My life partakes of infinity. April 1. At Hemlock Brook, a dozen or more yards from the river, I see on the wet mud a little snapping turtle, evidently hatched last year. It doesn't open its eyes or mouth while I hold it. Its eyes appear as if sealed by a long sleep. Talk of great heads, look at this one. What sort of cradle and nursing has this infant had? It totters forth confident and victorious when it can hardly carry its own shield. It looked so much like the mud, or a wet, muddy leaf. It was a wonder that I saw it. April 6th. All along the south side of this hill, and on the edge of a meadow, the air resounds with the hum of honeybees, attracted by the flower of the skunk cabbage. I first heard the fine, peculiar, sharp hum of the honeybee before I thought of them. Some hummed on a different pitch, perhaps to give notice to their fellow bees that the plant was occupied, for they repeatedly looked in and backed out on finding another one there. I was surprised to see them directed by their instincts to these localities, while the earth has still a wintry aspect. As they came out of the plants, they all had little yellow pellets of pollen on their thighs. So cute. The skunk cabbage comes out first in spring, so it's likely the first flower that the bees visit. April 9th. By the railroad, there's a leafy pool that will soon dry up. I see large water striders there, where the snow is not all melted. The skaters are playing on the first smooth and melted pool, just as boys on the first piece of ice in the winter. It must be cold on their feet. April 15th. The warm pine woods are all alive this afternoon with the jingle of the pine warbler, an invisible minstrel calling the trees to life. Its jingle rings through the woods at short intervals, a peculiar summer-like sound. May 3rd. In a pool in Warren's Meadow, I hear the ring of toads. Taking off my stockings and shoes, I stand in their midst. There are 100 toads close around me, and none have the peculiar rough belching croak, but a common musical ring, one that rings within a foot of me and seems to make the earth vibrate. I feel it, and I'm thrilled to my very spine. Such a serene sound. It reminds me of many a summer night on the river. May 8th. The full moon rises as I paddle by its light. It's an evening for the soft snoring of purring frogs. I never heard of them. I get within a few feet of them as they sit along the edge of a river, but I can't see them. This week I made a pair of corduroy pants, which cost me $1.60, and they are that peculiar clay color, like reflecting the earth. They're very strong, and they'll probably look the same even 3 months from now. So the birds are not afraid of me now. A mink came within 20 feet the other day, and if I had had my gray sack on as well as my corduroys, it probably would have come up to me. May 16th. Yesterday, a ruby-throated hummingbird came into our parlor and tasted my sister Sophia's flowers. In the sun, it glowed with splendid metallic fiery reflections around the neck and throat. It uttered a faint, squeaking chirp from time to time as it flew around the room. Its wings fanned so forcibly that I felt the cool wind a foot away. May 22nd. When Sophia and I were rowing past Mr. Pritchard's land, where the river is bordered by elm trees and willows, we heard a singular note of distress, as if it were a catbird. Well, blackbirds and others were flitting around the area, apparently attracted by it. But the sound came from the ground, not the trees. I saw a little black animal making haste to meet our boat. A young muskrat, I thought. No, it was a little dot of a kitten, scarcely 6 inches long from its face to the tip of its tail. It was very handsome and a very precocious kitten in perfectly good condition. It ceased mewing as it scrambled over the stones as fast as its little legs would allow, and it came straight to me. Once at home, it followed us everywhere at a rapid pace, and it sucked milk from our fingers and purred divinely. June 4th. A real catbird has her nest in our grove. We threw out strips of white cotton cloth, all of which she picked up and used. One bird flying across the street with such a long strip of cloth made me think of a little boy's kite with a long tail. The catbird sings less now, as it or its mate takes care of their young. June 13th. What was that rare and beautiful bird in the dark woods under the cliffs? all black above with white spots and bars and a large triangular blood red spot on its chest. I cannot find this bird described and think it must be a rose-breasted grosbeak, but it isn't. How much it enhances the wildness and the richness of the forest to see some beautiful bird which I've never detected before. June 17th. The sound of crickets at dawn after these first sultry nights seems like the dreaming earth continued into daylight. I love that early twilight hour when the crickets still creak right on with such faith that it's still night. I believe that while listening to the crickets' ambrosial sound, no crime can be committed. July 29th. Butterflies of various colors are now more abundant than I have ever seen. I counted 10 yesterday on a single flower. They were in harmony with the flower, opening and closing their wings together, preserving their balance. August 2nd. The fine zing of locusts in the grass, which I've heard for 3 days, is, methinks, an inspiring August sound. A certain maturity has pulsed the midsummer sluggishness. August 6th. I find a bumblebee asleep in a thistle blossom. The loiterer, having crowded himself in deep among the dense florets, is out of reach of the birds. What a sweet couch he has made. Personally, I'm pausing here on August 8th to let you know how I wish I had time to include the story about Thoreau tracking his father's missing pig. It's hilarious, and that pig took him on an amazing adventure, but I guess you'll have to buy the book to read it. September 16th. Grasshoppers have been very abundant in the dry fields for 3 weeks. Sophia walked through the depot field last night, and when she got home, she picked 50 or 60 from her skirt. Wouldn't this be a good way to clear a field? Send a bevy of fashionably dressed ladies across the field and leave it to them to clean their skirts when they get home. October 4th. The birds seem to delight in these first days of fall. Robins, bluebirds, phoebes, purple finches fill the air with their sweet song. But now the year itself begins to ripen, quite like the frost on a persimmon. October 16th. The broad, shallow water on each side of the river is bathed in withered grass, as if it were ready to put on its veil of ice at any moment. We're so near to winter. Then closer to home I hear two song sparrows on the button bushes, singing as if it's spring, as if it would be their last, as it was their first. November 7th. The fields are bleak, as if vacated. The very earth is like a house shut up for winter. I go knocking about in vain, but just then I hear a chickadee on a hemlock and was cheered to find an old acquaintance still stirring among the premises. I felt revived at once. November 25th. I saw a muskrat come out of a hole in the ice. He's a different sort. He would dive when I went near and then reappear again. What a cold-blooded fellow, sitting perfectly still on so long on ice. December 11th. In this bare landscape, I'm reminded of small birds in winter. They stay amid the cold, powdery snow as if it were a fruit of the season. They have wings that would take them quickly to regions of summer, but here's all the summer they want. It's as surprising as if you were to find a brilliant crimson flower that flourished amid the snow. While our maker makes this cold that is too much for me in, he at the same time made these warm and glowing creatures to twitter and be at home in it. January 30th. There are certain sounds invariably heard in the warm and thawing days of winter. Nature is in its tenderest mood possible, and I hear the very flutterings of her heart. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the value of listening to everything in and around you. There's so much more in this book that I think you would truly love. So use it for good in your life and the lives of everyone you love. And for those you don't love, use it for their good anyway. It's another small step in bringing peace to the world.